God promised that Abraham would have seed. How was that possible? He believed, verse 17, in a God who makes dead men alive and who calls non-existent things into existence. We have to be very fair and say that at this point, too, Paul is picking up descriptions of God that are not novel, but can be found in Judaism. Both of them. The God who makes alive dead people, the God who calls non-existent things into existence. But here, Paul brings them together with the situation of Abraham. He doesn't consider how a 90-year-old woman can be beautiful, because he says, not because, that's the wrong time. What he does say is that both Abraham and Sarah, so far as having kids were concerned, were dead. Abraham's faith in response to the promise of seed was to believe in the God who makes dead men alive. What is faith by this definition? Faith is putting one's self in front of God not only as the ungodly man, but as a dead man. There is very little reason to brag if you are both ungodly and dead. There is not much of which you are capable. Boasting is excluded. There's another thing which is excluded. That's the other of the great sins that Paul credits to Judaism. That is the sin of self-confidence. These two things, I would argue, Paul has stated as the problem with the Jew in Romans 2:17 and following. And notice how he brings that one to a conclusion. He agrees that not every Jew is a Jew, but at the end of chapter 2, he gives you a definition of Jewishness, which is a complete redefinition. For it is not the one who, at verse 28, who is a Jew in public view, nor the circumcision in full view in the flesh, but the Jew in secret and the circumcision of the heart in spirit, not in letter. And notice how it concludes, where the praise, the glory does not arise out of men, but out of God. Paul uses Abraham in Romans 4, as I read him, to completely undercut the position of the pious religious Jew. Let me formulate it most radically. Abraham becomes the example by which Paul shows that the greatest of all threats to God's justifying action is religion. Religion conceived of as that which man has or which man does. The greatest form of impiety known is piety, on Paul's terms. Questions before we make a quick jump to Galatians 3. time?
Are you asking about in terms of Paul's career?
Yeah.
Later. 2 Corinthians, written in Macedonia while Paul is on the way to Corinth, and it's in a 3-month stay when he arrives there that Romans is written. And let me add on, if my eisegetics has any verisimilitude, that Galatians is still later. I have the screwy theory that Galatians is written on shipboard while Paul is sailing to Jerusalem at the end of the third missionary journey, and is posted somewhere from Southern Asia Minor. It accounts for a lot of things, but that's an argument that I'll have with George another day.
See, I just want to underscore one thing which I think you were kind of hinting at, and that is that you or Paul radically opposed the Jubilee kind of idea of trying to knock any supposition of Abraham as the father of human nature. It makes very clear that even among the circumcised, Abraham promises of God the one only the Isaac. Paul, nothing arguing against Jubilee, but certainly arguing against the Jews.
Any other question? If not, we go to Galatians 3. To Paul's, the other formulation of the Abraham material, where Paul raises an old question in a new form. That is, an old question both for him and for Judaism. The matter under discussion is fundamentally the same. Jewish-Christian polemic. The first 5 verses of Galatians 3 are simply an argument from experience. How did you people get spirit? You didn't get it by doing works of the law. You got it when you heard preaching of Jesus Christ as crucified.
Just a simple question. What does works of the law mean?
Works of the law. Hold that one. Maybe we'll get there, Ralph. For Paul, erga nummu are anything that a man does by which he creates for himself anything that can resemble bragging or self-confidence.
The point is that it's not what we in our technical jargon call a good work.
Oh, no.
Like circumcision, keeping the Sabbath. Am I on the right track?
I think that's a little bit too easy. Anything that a man can do, which would include obeying the Ten Commandments, that is used by that man as evidence for his religiosity, for the fact that he stands with God. That's why I formulate on the basis of Romans 4 that in Paulian terms, the greatest impiety is piety. Piety understood as those acts which a man does. And Paul conceives that it is possible for a man who has, on his own terms, heard the gospel to try to graft such a piety onto the gospel. It's not only pre-Christian, it can be post-Christian. And it's so radical that if you add it on, you move back into the pre-Christian states. After this, yeah.
I don't know what you want to get into this, but I mean, if you given, put Paul in the context of a conflict between Jews and Christians, don't you think it would be helpful if you would give us some idea of how a Jew might understand the same thing that Paul's talking about? That is, Torah would not be what Paul means by law, and those might, his argument seems to be a little different.
That was what I was trying to do in shorthand by saying that on the one hand, Paul is not an academic theologian. He does not start really with the text of the Old Testament to read the Pentateuch and then to ask, out of that, what is it that demonstrates, out in the Torah, what is it that is there that shows how God claims a man by grace? I think that Paul, as polemicist, is speaking to very specific people. And the identification, either within Judaism or Jewish Christianity, would be very difficult. For example, now let's pick this one right up. One can make a very strong case for saying that the concept of justification, which you have in Paul, very, very closely parallel in the Hodiyotik Qumran, where the psalm writer will say, you know, I'm a worm, I'm a louse, I can't do a thing. But because the righteousness of God will cover my sins. I was hoping to do two other models from the New Testament itself, which I think come out quite differently from Paul. One of them is even more radically anti-Jewish, and one of them much more positive. Confessio Pauper Sacris, in The Amount of Time and Science, and knowing that George was doing something with Judaism, I frankly disregarded it. Thank you. fallen terms in history. No, I'm going to let that for a question, John. Second point. The second problem is that of determining who is seed of Abraham. And Paul gives a rather confusing answer, interpreting the same word, sperma, both as a singular and as a collective in the same definition. Now, I'll say only that much,
because if there's any time left for discussion, I'm sure somebody will ask more about it.
Okay. Hebrews is not apologetic. Hebrews is a sermon. In fact, the book of Hebrews may be the first complete long sermon we have from Brings of Christianity. It calls that itself that. What am I saying? It calls itself in chapter 13, verse 22, a speech of exhortation, a word of exhortation. It is clearly, therefore, directed to an inner Christian situation. And that situation is one which Hebrews responds to in a way that made Luther very uncomfortable with it, because he said it contradicts the grace of God at least twice in Hebrews 6 and in Hebrews 10. For the book says that if you have been baptized and then left, that's it. You pass. There is no second repentance. You cannot once again save the grace of God. That's not the reason for saying that. Is to make the point that the problem which Hebrews is addressing is that of Christianity, which is in danger of growing lukewarm and of compromising with the necessity of confessing its faith. And a drastic problem often requires drastic measures. In its own way, Hebrews is as drastically radical as was St. Paul. Abraham comes up three times in the book of Hebrews. He is first mentioned in Hebrews 2:16 in a Christological passage, where the author says that in order to destroy death, Abraham and Abraham's seed is the thing to which Christ had to love them. The seed of Abraham is what Christ had to lay hold of. He had to participate in the humanness of Abraham, rather than being an angelic being. That's the last reference to the angelic being, a topic which had been begun in Hebrews 1, that Christ is more than an angel. And one can say that the more includes not only the fact that he was that revelatory word, the more also includes the fact, and George mentioned this at the end yesterday, that he is fully human. This fully human Jesus is of the seed of Abraham. The second passage is longer and more significant. It is the last part of Hebrews 6, which leads up to the great discussion of the Melchizedekian priesthood of Jesus in Hebrews 7. Hebrews 6 had begun with this huge exhortation. You've got to stay fast. It concludes, that exhortation does, in verses 11 and 12,
by saying, we want each one of you to have that same zeal for the full assurance of faith, of hope until the end, in order that you not, might not become, uses a rather impolite word, bastard, but be imitators through faith and patience of those who inherited the promise. Abraham becomes, as he was in Paul, the model figure for Christian life. It's interesting that Hebrews comes much closer to the Jewish tradition. Abraham is a model of faith precisely because he endured. He was patient. He waited. We are to be like Abraham. He mentions in verse 12, 11 and 12, we should imitate them. Abraham becomes the example. It was to Abraham that God made the promise. That promise which he swore by his own name. That promise that came with an eternal oath. That oath which lasted to eternity called forth, verse 15, a corresponding patience that lasted until the end, until he attained to the promise. What that promise is difficult to say. Probably, it is either the birth of Isaac, compare Hebrews 11:11, or more generally, the certainty that he would have seed. I say that because of what I will say shortly about Hebrews 11. We need to make, however, one other fact clear. Why is Abraham so significant? It is because he was in contact with Melchizedek. And the primary Christology, or soteriology, you may use either word, of Hebrews is Melchizedekian. There is a sense in which the whole book of Hebrews is nothing more or less than a commentary on Psalm 110, verses 1 and 4. The Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand until I make your enemies the footstool under your feet. You are a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. Abraham paid tithes to Melchizedek. That's what chapter 7 says. And he did that as the verse we want is, where is it? Verse 4. He did that as patriarche, the man who began the race. That very fact demonstrates the superiority of Jesus as Melchizedekian priest to the whole of the Levitical institution. For, using a good Jewish idea, that in the seed, the sperm of the male, there is actually contained all of the subsequent progeny. Notice how he says that. Levi, verse 10, was still inside of Abraham's loins. That is, Levi himself shared in the paying of tithes to Melchizedek. Abraham paid tithes to a non-Jewish priest. But that priest's non-Jewishness is significant because, now, in early Christian exegesis, that priest is at one and the same time the one who is Son of God. And originally, messianic title, but now applied in a peculiar sense, Hebrews 1:1-4, to Jesus. And this Melchizedekian priest has gone through the process, Hebrews 4:14, so by which he has completed his life, gone through the heavens, and is now seated at the right hand of God. That accounts for one of those strange things that in Hebrews, what Paul had called hope becomes faith. If you define faith in Hebrews, it becomes, end of chapter 6, the anchor thrown forward. Why? Because the struggle of human life is to endure until you have arrived where the priest is, who is gone through the heavens, seated at the right hand of God. And Abraham, in chapter 11, becomes the model of that. Yeah. Chapter 11 is one of those surveys of history, you will recall. What does this book land on? The promise is the promise of the land. That's the key. When he first got that call, verse 8, Abraham went out even though he didn't know where he was going. And he never arrived at the promise. He didn't make it. Verse 13, Abraham, Sarah, and what have you, these all died according to faith, but not having arrived at, attained the promises. What were they? Abraham's faith consisted in this, that seeing the promises from a far distance and at least giving them a great greeting, nevertheless, he confessed that he was still stranger and resident alien upon the earth. Why? Because the Melchizedekian priest has shown that the reality is not on this earth. Hebrews operates with almost a platonic view of the world. The true reality is where the priest is, the true temple, the true city whose builder and maker is God. Faith, therefore, demonstrated by Abraham, who becomes the model to be imitated. That's the point that George was making yesterday. Abraham as model for life is best imitated when you obey, endure, because you know that your reality lies in the future. This picture, like that of James, is much closer to that of contemporary Judaism. In fact, one might say, it is very Jewish. The only change that is made, the only tinkering, is the identification of Melchizedek with Christ and what that does to the concept of enduring. Third example, the Gospel of Matthew. Matthew does not use Abraham very much. He's mentioned by name three times. And once he is there, I think, but not mentioned. The genealogy begins with him, because Christ must be son of Abraham. That's chapter 1. He is mentioned in John the Baptist's proclamation in chapter 3. God can make I didn't find this kind of faith in Israel. I tell you that many will come from east and west and will recline with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in the kingdom of the heavens. But the sons of the kingdom will be thrown out into the exterior darkness. There will be weeping, crying, and people grinding their teeth. Matthew shows some of his biases by where he puts that wondering passage. It's in a different context in Luke's gospel. Here it is used to draw the implication from the healing of the centurion's servant, the fourth place where Abraham shows up, as I said, I think, unnamed. Matthew 16. The confession at Caesarea Philippi. (coughs) 16:13 and following. In the answer which Jesus gives to Simon Peter, he says, Simon, you are blessed. Flesh and blood did not reveal this unto you. And I'm going to give you another revelation. You are Petrus, and on this Petra I will build my church. That statement is illuminated by one passage that George had from the Old Testament that skipped in his reading, Isaiah 51. Look to the rock from which you were cut. Look to the quarry from which you were hewn. And the interpretation of that passage in later Jewish tradition. Quote, a king planned the building of a great palace, dug in several places, seeking proper ground for a foundation. At last he struck rock beneath and said, here will I build. So he laid the foundation and built. Just so when God sought to create the world, he examined the generation of Enoch and the generation of the flood and said, how can I create the world when these wicked people will rise up and provoke me to anger? When he saw Abraham, who was to arise, he said, now I have found a rock on which to build and establish the world. I don't need to rehearse for you all the places in the book of Matthew in which that book expresses disappointment with the Jewish people. Most of them are unique to Matthew's gospel. His blood be on us and on our children. That's the culminating one. I don't know what this is going to do to your understanding of missionary work. Remember how Matthew 28 ends up? Go ye therefore and make disciples of whom? Panta ta ethne, all the Gentiles. I think by intention that excludes the Jews. The Jews, my good friend Bob will say, that's really unfair. The Matthean viewpoint is that the time for preaching to Jews is past. They have excluded themselves by their attitude. It's time to get to the business of preaching to people who listen, Gentiles. That's why I would call the Gospel of Matthew the Gospel against the Jewish people. That shows that Abraham is being used in Matthew 16, Matthew 7, as a basis to argue that the Christian church, the Matthean church, is really Israel, and that hoi judaioi are excluded from it, the Jews. You see, in these four views of Abraham in Christianity, four quite different applications. And I went over 10 minutes. I'll be happy to answer questions, or the chairman here can shut me up.